The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
You and I, Kevin, look at debt and we say, this is a big problem. For the mucky mucks, they'd say, it's not a big problem because we have something at our fingertips that you don't have, and that's the power to coerce. We can force the variables, and if you don't like it, we'll force your face into the mud. I mean, this is the nature of politics. It gets dirty at a certain point, and I think this is where we're at in this time frame.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. We live in a day, Dave, of shifting sand, and everything seems relative. You know, we're watching two candidates a couple of nights ago, you know, campaigning against each other that you can't really put a finger on at all what either one truly believe. You know, we've seen a two-party system. We've been told that those are the only two options that we have. But there are some consistent things that you can measure that I'd like to start with before we talk about the debates. I know the debates have been on everybody's mind. You know, was there a winner? Was there a loser? But when we were talking before this commentary, we actually were reminiscing a little bit about a 15-year-old's birthday party and how you can teach someone to measure not relative to shifting sand, but actually relative to something that has been solid for thousands of years.
Well, okay, we live in a post-Bretton Woods world. That
right.
was the agreement that after World War II aligned currencies to being measured in dollar terms, with the backing of the dollar being gold.
There was a gold guarantee originally.
Once we left the Bretton Woods system, we entered onto a floating currency system. And to be able to judge the value of one currency against the other becomes very difficult because they're both floating. So you see more exaggerated trends show up one versus the other, but they both could be going down at the same time, and it'd be very difficult to tell the difference. And I feel like we've had a loss of value, just like we lost the plumb line for currencies. So we've lost a larger values plumb line. And I was reminded of that in this last week's debate between the Republican and Democratic candidates, because essentially we have a system of floating values, nothing that is tied or related to something real and constant.
Right.
And so it's difficult to really say what is right or wrong with either one of them, because they both seem to be shifting down, maybe to one degree or another at a faster pace and at a different time and place at a faster pace.
Monetarily, Dave, there was a standard. You talked about Bretton Woods and how the dollar was backed by gold at one time. In 1971, when Nixon closed the gold window, your dad saw that as a time to continue to reach for gold because the government had taken it off of currency. I was 8 years old at the time when that occurred. I should have been taught to continue to measure things in gold as well. I know that you try, Dave, with your own kids and with others, to try to teach them to reach for the discipline that would measure things in gold so that they actually understand what's the real value of something.
Well, a part of it is trying to have them focus on what is real. And it's almost impossible in the context of a presidential debate because virtually nothing is real.
Like Pilate said, what is truth?
Yeah. Well, right. In this case, what is reality? And we've got two people who, frankly, I don't even care. They're willing to say whatever it takes to get elected.
Right.
But what is real? You know, back to the friend's birthday party, 15 years old, and, you know, we're reflecting on the changes in value over time. And I gave him two things. I gave him a banknote and I gave him a silver coin. One is worthless. The other increases in value relative to the currency that it's priced in.
Now, the banknote that you gave him was the German mark back from the 1920s,
well,
right?
That's right. It was a 10 yeah. million German mark. And 10 million marks, I mean, you'd think, well, being a millionaire, is that significant? Well, it is if there is substance to that currency. And if that currency has lost substance, then what is the significance of being a millionaire?
Hmm.
I mean, keep in mind, we've moved from it being a big deal to be a millionaire. You were wealthy as a millionaire to now there being a recalibration. Only if you are a multi-billionaire are you truly amongst the upper crust,
right,
so to say. So you look at the change in value, and we discussed more recently the move in the Mexican peso.
That's been dropping. You mentioned last week that it is hitting all-time lows against the dollar.
Well, right. If you go back to the 92-93 period, we had massive devaluations in the currency and they tried to stabilize it. We had rates that were catastrophic in that time frame for the Mexican people. And once they stabilized the currency, I would say post 92-93, this is the worst we've seen the peso since then. And how does that translate? Again, we're looking at a piece of paper, which has through time become worthless, and we're looking at 1 ounce of silver, which is actually, it was a Mexican once. I gave him that to illustrate a particular point.
So you gave this young man a banknote, basically a currency from Germany in the 1920s, and a Mexican onza that is an ounce of silver, but it also had a peso designation so that you could compare it to the currency.
Well, that's right. So in U.S. dollar terms, the price of silver is, going back to October of 2008, price of silver is up about 110%.
Right.
And the strength of the peso was there in 2008 at about a 10-to-1 exchange rate. Now we're close to 20-to-1. On the U.S. dollar Mexican peso exchange rate, 19 and change. And so you see the ounce of silver in U.S. dollar terms has gone up 110%.
But in peso terms?
In peso terms, it's up over 300%. Mm. So both currencies have devalued, one more than the other. And this is the point, and what I hoped that this young man would remember. Is the metals price moving up, or are those currencies on the proverbial trail of tears? Are they going on a very long and arduous and difficult and even deadly journey from a monetary perspective? Yeah, maybe it's unfair to look at the presidential candidates and say we're on a similar trail of tears, but the reality is we're not arguing about real things anymore.
Right.
The point is we've lost a plumb line for value, both in the monetary and in the political, cultural aspects of life.
You know, I was talking to my wife this morning after watching the debate, and I told her, I said, if there was a man of integrity, man or woman of integrity on the stage at the time that actually just told the truth, that would trump, pun intended, actually, that would trump both Trump and Hillary. We just don't seem to have that integrity anymore. In fact, you know, I look at this growing audience right now of people who just can't stand politicians. Now, Trump played on that a little bit, but people are sick of lifer politicians. They're sick of just seeing the two-party option and people who say, look, you're going to pay my bills and you're going to give me a pension for the rest of my life and you're going to listen to what I have to say.
Well, and he's very effectively positioned himself as the Washington outsider.
Mm-hmm.
And that comes at a time when, as you say, there is a growing audience that doesn't like the life of politicians. They don't like the culture which they've seen created in D.C., a culture of cronyism and of lobbied priorities, which have really set the tone for what may in the future become sort of a political reshuffle.
Right.
And you can already see sort of the aversion to the status quo, and it goes from left to right in terms of the political spectrum. Doesn't matter whether you're conservative or liberal, you see this, I've probably seen bumper stickers that say, feel the burn.
You're right.
Feel the burn. That's an expression of millennial discontent with the status quo. I think it'll be very interesting as we move through this election cycle to count the third party votes in this election and see if it's not the biggest in recent history, where a generation says, and a growing audience of people say to themselves, I don't really like either option that I'm given, and I'm not feeling compelled on the lines of party loyalty or a scare tactic because of the judiciary, which may be whatever, it may become an absolute crisis in the next 30 or 40 years. That's not compelling enough for me to sacrifice either my vote or my integrity. I must vote for someone or something I believe in. That's what you're seeing in terms of the millennial expression of discontent.
Well, and I want to talk about revolution at some point, because we've seen revolutions in the past where, you know, the false dilemma or the false dichotomy of just two choices is thrown out. We saw that back with the American Revolution. You had the Whigs and the Tories, and you had everybody arguing about those two parties. And then you had the colonists who basically said, no, we're going to throw that off. And only the old guard argue that a protest vote is thrown away. And, you know, that seems to be the argument at this point. People saying, well, gosh, if you vote third party, don't you understand the judiciary is going to be lost for the next 30 years? They're absolutely right. But the problem is, how long have we sold our soul to the devil by continuing to just bite at one bait or the other? There's a hook in both.
Well, that's right. And I think this is a message which has been told to the boomers. It's been believed by the boomers, and it's something they have continued to perpetuate. this threat of the loss of the judiciary. I guess the real question is, can you show me a substantive difference in the appointments under a Republican versus a Democrat? You've seen some catastrophic appointments under both, and it doesn't lead me to think that there is very much at stake in the final analysis. It doesn't hold this idea that you should not, quote unquote, throw your vote away. That doesn't hold with a generation that has questioned whether or not it's worth their time to vote at all,
right,
or if it matters, if their vote matters in the grand scheme of things. You're dealing with a younger generation, again, who may not have a huge bearing on this election, but they will define the course of the body politic in future elections. What are they after? They're after an authentic, truthful expression of values, and that is a greater priority for them than the choice of the lesser of two evils. This is a generation that is watching how people vote and will serve as those who indict the current generation who would say, don't quote unquote throw your vote away. You must not let it get in the hands of so and so. Republicans do the same thing as Democrats. Democrats the same thing as Republicans. You know, be aware of how you're going to throw the election into the hands of the quote unquote enemy. This is a generation who is going to judge that advice and judge it very harshly as something that lacked ethics.
Well, speaking of that generation, we've seen generations in the past that really turned away from the vote completely and went to pitchforks and torches and guillotines. And I wonder how, with the outcome of however this vote comes up, Dave, whether a person is a Trump or a Hillary or a third party or what have you, I wonder with the social expression that's coming up right now, the anger, this angst against everything. We talked about Brexit. You know, all the polls said that Brexit was not going to pass. And so the establishment was very comfortable that Brexit would not pass. And then, sure enough, Brexit passed. They didn't know what to do with it.
Well, I don't think Trump did very well in the debate. That doesn't mean that his numbers are going to change at all, because the man in the street, frankly, doesn't care about a debate. He cares about the status quo, and he feels angry about not being well represented or taken care of.
Do you think this is the last hurrah of the old guard at this point?
I do. I think you're looking at a generation of selfish and power-hungry leaders on both sides of the aisle, and what they're setting the stage for is a youth-driven revolution of interests.
Revolution
of interests. I mean, yeah. where people that are today counting on Social Security, they're going to face a generation that is supposed to fund their Social Security payments who are asking a different set of questions. Things like this. Haven't you taken enough?
Mm.
Haven't you damaged the environment enough? Haven't you set yourself up comfortably enough on the backs of the world's needy and attempted to corner the market on luxury and excess, using your contacts and connections to protect against change, positive change? Haven't you tried to tell us that we need to vote just like you? The next administration is going to define the kind of war on inequality that we have. And it's going to define it by setting in motion the biases of a younger generation and defining what they believe about the people back in Washington. It's fascinating to me from a sociological perspective far more than from a political perspective. Frankly, it's probably because I'm jaded by ideas from my dad. He'd say, there's not a dime's worth of difference between the Republicans and Democrats.
Right.
And I think this is where, again, the farce of you must choose A or you must choose B, there will never be a change. There will never be a change to consider C, D, E, or F as options until you have a generation who's willing to throw it all away and not feel that there is something at risk.
You know, when you read about false dilemma on Wikipedia, one of the things they say is a false dilemma can arise intentionally when a fallacy is used in an attempt to force a choice or an outcome. Now, I want to talk today, Dave, about some of the dangers that whoever wins this election may face. And actually, it may not be the best thing that the best candidate win, just for future reference. But let's go ahead and look at what has changed. You know, you're talking about this millennial generation. When I talk to my son about things related to the internet, or things, just my using the word internet makes me sound already old-fashioned. Okay, there's words that I don't even know. That there's a different way of thinking. This is a generation that has learned that information is free. Our generation, we still get on Amazon.com and pay full retail for our books. They don't think that way. They leapfrog with their technology the old way of thinking. Do you think maybe this politically connected one side, let's say the Democrats, facing the moneyed interests, let's say on the Republican side, this third option might be something we've never thought of before, Dave.
When I think about the millennials, the reality is I don't understand them. And I think it's why for the longest time I have underestimated them.
Right.
And what we're looking at in terms of the disruptions in business today, where tech undoes the old models and leapfrogs them, I think that's going to hit the political arena over the next 10 years. And it's going to welcome in, it's going to introduce to Washington a whole new group of outsiders. And I think this election is today, obviously, between the politically connected and the moneyed interests, but what is coming is going to be very different. You may not be of the moneyed crowd. You may not be stacked with a political Rolodex that allows you to make a few calls and get lots of things done, including raising funds. But again, this notion of disruption in business, given a tech workaround, I think we're going to see that in the political sphere as well. And it's one of the things that will empower a millennial generation to reshape the world. And that may be for the good. That may not be for the good. That remains to be seen, the kinds of values that they're willing to promote.
Did you get the impression, watching the debate, though, Dave, that with $20 trillion in debt, with some of the international political struggles that we have both in the Middle East and in Asia, did you get the impression that either candidate should be in office at this point and could handle that? Or do you think they're going to be the guys who are left holding the really heavy bag?
And I think that's the conclusion I'm coming to. The biggest loser in this election is the one that wins.
Mm.
The party and what the person represents will not show well over the next 4 to 8 years. There are so many imbalances baked into the economic and political cake that what we will witness over the next 1 and/or 2 terms is revulsion to whomever and whatever is in office. And I'd like to take the opposite view of my dad here. He argues that a Trump win is a victory against the establishment. 2016 sets the stage for bigger issues to be defined and prioritized by the electorate in the ensuing 4 years. I think Trump wins, and it's actually an establishment victory. Hmm. This is just my opinion, but here's why I say it. What does that presuppose? Number one, that we're at an economic tipping point. Okay, that's a key in my thinking. We've been able to postpone a severe economic correction, a deleveraging event for 8 years by releveraging the financial system with an extra $60 trillion in debt. Now, that's globally. And if you look at $12 trillion, which is just central bank balance sheet expansion, I don't think that we can postpone that deleveraging any longer. Leading me to my second point, which is if the central bank is not helping you, they may inadvertently be hurting you. This is what I would call the central bank aided crucible. Okay. And this is where if Trump wins and the political and sort of the personality bias that is against Trump at the Fed, and I say that because the majority of folks that work at Fed are Democrats.
Right.
I think that political and personality bias will become obvious. The Fed can shrink his empire by 80%. I'm talking about his personal balance sheet by raising interest rates. They can also trigger a recession that will define the tone of his administration. DC is a jungle. DC is absolutely a jungle. And this is what it brings to mind for me. If the Fed wants to make life difficult for you, do you remember the movie The Predator with Arnold Schwarzenegger?
Oh, sure.
Okay.
Oh, sure.
Well, if the Fed wants to, they could drop you in the middle of the jungle, that's DC, right? Without arms, facing the predator. They just leave you to get skinned alive by the marketplace, right? So this brings me to the third point, which is a framed failure. Okay. A framed failure. Whoever is in office over the next 4 years is going to get caught holding the bag.
Well, and speaking of holding the bag, okay, let's just go back and look at this, because if this is intentional, like I was talking before about this dilemma that we have, you may have a designated bag holder for this financial correction. Bag holder comes from, you know, shareholders caught up in corporate bankruptcies who are left holding the bag. It's a statement that actually goes back to, you know, the 1700s in Britain. If there was a thief who wanted to get away and had to hand the bag to somebody, they handed it to the guy left holding the bag. Do you think possibly either a Hillary or a Trump would be the ones left holding the bag, and whatever occurs after that will be the reaction opposite what they represent.
That's right. So let's go neutral and say it just doesn't matter who wins. The global economic imbalances and the massive quantities of debt are in the process of coming undone now, not tomorrow, not 6 months from now, now.
They're barely making it to the election, Dave. They've kept the Dow at 18,000 something for 3 months.
Have you noticed sort of the suspended, the gravitational pulls?
Yeah.
I mean, we've been 18, 3 months in a row.
Right.
And yeah, I think the biggest loser is the one that wins. And I, for one, would prefer that capitalists, that business owners, that conservatives not be blamed for what has been a bipartisan catastrophe developed over the last 20 to 30 years. And we all take risks. I appreciate that. And the calculation and my risk taking in this analysis includes some cause and effect. And I hope that the show we are about to see demonstrates to a generation that socialist redistribution, and quite frankly, the more extreme expression of that is in the DNC platform. A softer version is in the RNC platform.
Right, right.
I want a generation to see that the socialist redistribution is not an answer, but is the worst expression of a systemic problem. If Trump wins, anything remotely market-related gets tarred and feathered. Hillary wins, guess what? It's the status quo politics that gets re-engineered as a reaction to the failure of not only her term, but the 8 years that preceded. Democrat, Democrat, Democrat. I want to know who gets caught holding the bag. And frankly, anyone who has a market orientation, even if I don't like him, I'm not inclined to see him get caught holding the bag because of the social and long-term political implications.
Dave, we've been talking about chess grandmasters here over the last couple of weeks. And in a chess game, sometimes you'll see a sacrifice of a very valuable piece, a queen, a rook, and you'll look at the board and you'll be like, what in the world were they thinking? They sacrificed the queen. They've given up the game. And then you find out later that it was a beautiful sacrifice and it wins the game ultimately for the person who sacrificed their queen. Now, I'm wondering, okay, let's say you're the establishment. You and I both know it's not the president who runs the country. There is an establishment that's above that that may be playing the long game. And if you're playing the long game and you say, all right, we have a financial crisis that has to come apart. We've bought 8 years with the Federal Reserve being on our side. Do you think maybe the establishment says, fine then, let's go ahead and let Trump have it. Let him hold the bag because we have so much more after that that we can incorporate.
I don't know what the establishment is feeling other than they don't like him.
Yeah.
And he makes them sick.
Right.
But on the other hand, right, do they reach a point where they say, fine then. Let him have it. Let him have it. Trump wins. And as a greater depression unfolds in the absence of a monetary policy prop for assets and its trade competitiveness increases, as wars begin to start, budget deficits begin to reblossom and bloom, who's going to be the man who's dealing with debt rollover issues as rates are rising?
Mm-hmm.
And who then is going to come swooping back in as the knight on the white horse?
Right.
And people don't realize that right now, the establishment is, in fact, losing its grip. They are. That's a current reality. But they may be able to get a better grip post-Trump. In that way, in my opinion, I think Trump is an establishment victory.
You know, you had made a comment. Being a McIlvaney, you read a lot of things that I didn't read when I was a teenager. Okay. When you were a teenager, you read Taylor Caldwell's The Devil's Advocate. You were explaining to me how that may have some play in this particular instance.
What it did is it had me reflecting on good and evil and what appears good and what appears evil. And, you know, I maybe was a little young to read it, reflecting on a sort of a dystopian culture where in every aspect of life there was command and control dynamics. It was sort of an extreme version of communism, if you will. And written in 1953, when there was a real awareness of quote unquote red threat.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, what it makes me think, you've got the villain in the story who in some respects ends up being the hero. And it turns around your preconceived notion of what is good and what is evil. And you don't necessarily know the motives of people in office. So judging good and evil, and frankly, if you took sort of the 40,000 foot view and said, we don't know ultimately what's good or evil for our culture, for our nation on a longer frame. I've seen evil done in the name of good.
Right.
Under a Republican administration. I've seen evil done in the name of good under a Democratic administration. And I don't think either one of them has a corner on evil or on what can be done in the name of good. So to me, that's where Caldwell's the devil's advocate. I begin to say, look, I'm not sure what actually is going to be best for this country long term. But I think even the scare of losing the judiciary, Republicans have done a really bad job of that, as have Democrats, in my opinion. So I don't know that there's much to lose there. That may be a bit of a canard.
Well, and I want to go back to the thinking that there may be backlash on whoever takes office this particular time, because what we're actually saying is, to play the long game or to watch the long game, we really need to be thinking about the 2020 election.
Well, that's
because
right.
Whoever's 2016 is probably going to be backlashed against on 2020.
Yeah, think about that. To understand 2016, you have to see 2020.
Mm.
Yeah, take on 2020 vision. And you'll better understand what's happening in this election. What occurs over the next 4 years will set the tone in social and political discourse for a generation.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's at stake, in my opinion. Pain shapes social consciousness far more than the slow grip of Gramscian socialism.
Mm.
Pain in the form of job loss, pain in the form of losing your home, in the form of wealth evaporation, and the other consequences of deleveraging, which I think are going to define a perspective for a generation. And it's the youth of today that will define the America of tomorrow. So what is their experience of life over the next 4 to 8 years?
Mm-hmm.
Think carefully about these causal connections, and they may be specious. There may be zero connection in reality between what happens in the next 4 years in the marketplace and people's experience of life being harder and harder and the people in office, but that causal connection will be made. And it will be made over the next 4 to 8 years. And again, I think it's in a way that has a generation defining a political objective. That's what has me concerned.
I think at this point, we need to revisit the talk that you had with one of our past guests, Neil Howe. One of the great books that was written in the late 20th century was The Fourth Turning, because it went back 600 years and looked at the seasons of social change. And, you know, you have about a 20 to 25 year period called the First Turning. That's when there's usually a spiritual awakening and things are changing. Then you have sort of young maturity in a society, and then it goes to older maturity, and then age, this fourth turning. So you have the 1, 2, 3, 4 turning. Are we in a fourth turning? Howe thought that we began, the author of the book, thought that we had begun the fourth turning in 2008.
Neil Howe's first book was written in the 80s, and he wrote it with Pete Peterson, who now runs the Peterson Institute, was head of the CFR for years, and has done some interesting things as a part of Blackstone, a major private equity firm. And what I think is interesting is they were looking at massive fiscal imbalances in the late 80s and saying, by the time we get to 2020 to 2040, this time frame, we're going to be dealing with numbers that will crush the system.
Right. Okay?
That led him to his early 90s work on generations and looking at a study of how different generations deal with problems and what generations tend to look like. Is there any similarity between generations or any patterns that we can divine from looking at a longer swath of history? And out of that, he came up with the fourth turning. The fourth turning is this notion that, in fact, history has a cyclical character to it.
Right.
And about every four generations, 80 to 100 years, you have this secular cycle.
And it usually ends with depression and war.
Well, that's right. The fourth turning, this is the question. The fourth turning is like this. If there's four, the fourth is like winter.
So you have spring, summer, fall. The winter is the death of that particular system.
That's right. And the winter precedes a period of regeneracy or growth.
Right.
He would argue that we're in a fourth turning now. Are we in one? I mean, this is the question I'm asking. Who would you want as president if this is the final stage of a fourth turning? It's a question of how we want the pendulum to swing. The millennials will be the generation charged with putting Humpty Dumpty back together again. And if the first turning represents a reaction to the ideas and leadership of the fourth turning, what do you want the social and political animal to be that is being rejected?
Mm-hmm.
Do you see what I'm getting at?
Sure.
So Neil Howe, he's one of the authors of The Fourth Turning. He suggested that in 2008, we kicked off The Fourth Turning, and that these shifts take about 20 years to complete, about a full generation. So we're roughly halfway through that. This is the phase where institutional incompetence is most on display. This is the period when boomers are in fact going to be retiring, moving on to a different phase in life with different sets of priorities, where the X generation, Generation X, they're the new adults. They're the new parents. Right. They're making a set of decisions different than they would have before because of the responsibilities that are on their plate right now. And who is defining young adulthood today and redefining to some degree? It is the millennials.
Dave, I was just reading this morning about how the Fortune 100 companies of the Fortune 100s, there's not one single CEO that's publicly supporting Trump. And so I'm wondering if down deep inside, they want to not be seen holding the bag either. There seems to be a disconnect between Trump and the Fortune 100 CEOs. And I seriously doubt that they're all Democrats, but maybe they sense something coming too. You know, if you're there working with a company, you actually can see the economy for what it is.
You know, if you continue with the music, if you let the music continue to play, you'd never introduce that stress of, do I have a chair, right? And if the music stops, I think they're making a calculated bet that the music does not stop if a Democrat is elected. Yeah. And if that's the case, then why would we have to reorient ourselves or decision-making towards finding a chair? Just let the party continue.
It's like what Richard Duncan said a few weeks ago. He said, you know, this is going to be so bad when it stops. Let's just go ahead and keep paying into the party.
Well, and I think that's what you have. 100 Fortune 100 CEOs all in support of Clinton. This is one of her challenges. There's enough people who know that she is very connected, that she is tied into the bowels of Wall Street and of corporate America, and that she's not a Bernie Sanders. She can't really ever pose or convince anyone that she's an outsider in any way.
Right, right.
that's just not. And by the way, she is a part of the 0.1%, both on net worth and on current income. She represents the minority, which is now in vogue to hate, right? And so how does she end up winning over the millennials? She doesn't, but she can on a self-interested basis, perhaps maintain the audience with the old guard.
Well, let's go ahead and go through the generations then. Generations are a particular focus of the Strauss and Howe book. So go ahead and go through a little bit of the background of the various generations and how they see things.
I mentioned that was the title of their book in 1991, Generations. That led them to write The Fourth Turning. And they point out that generations are defined to an extent by what they know and by what they don't know, what is a part of their collective memory. Boomers, for instance, are the first generation to have no direct experience or memory of World War II.
Right, they follow the greatest generation is what we call them.
That's right, or the silent generation. Generation X was born after the assassination of John F. Kennedy.
Right.
If you were born before, you know exactly where you were on that day.
Mm-hmm.
If you were born after, you may know it as a historical footnote. If you remember from your civics class, there was a president and he was assassinated and it was in Dallas. That's about as granular as it gets, but you have no personal investment in it.
Right.
So Gen X was born after the assassination of John F. Kennedy. And Howe points out that Woodstock is this sort of generational defining event that is not a part of the collective consciousness of millennials. And in fact, the complete redefining of marriage and family, which began in the 60s and 70s and 80s, it preceded the millennials altogether. So the things that they assume to be the case about society were reshaped just before they were born. Why am I bringing this up? Well, look over the next 8 to 10 years, and you're either looking at the president that presides over the greatest crisis this country has seen since the Depression, world wars, or at least a one-termer that gets caught in the crossfire of too much debt, too many budgetary promises, and a breakdown in globalization. Again, on a scale that we haven't seen in 70 to 80 years.
Okay, so the question that you're asking is not who's going to be in office, but who better to blame?
In essence, you're right. The man or woman at the helm is going to be dealing with economic collapse, with social chaos domestically, with a decline in international relations, which typically accompanies a major geopolitical conflict. Howe would say this is where all of your bloodletting occurs on an international basis. So you're right. I'm not asking the question who makes better decisions under duress. I'm asking what the impressions are, right or wrong, of the leaders who are making decisions in the context of crisis. Mm. I'm asking a market question. I'm asking what Keynes asked, not what is of greater value, but how is the beauty contest going to go? How will the judges judge this? as the next 8 to 10 years play out.
Well, and you know, when you were talking to Carmen Reinhart a couple of weeks ago, it was interesting, shocking, but it should have been obvious to me that the Fed's mandate wasn't necessarily to pay off the debt. So it hit me at that point, wait a second, they're going to just continue this as long as they can, because the debt's not their problem. The mandates that they have, they're actually playing out right now, and they're doing it with debt. They're doing it with completely unpayable debt. But it hit me exactly what House said recently in an interview with Martinson. Okay, no one simply solves a terrible problem on a sunny day when they can afford, at least for the time being, to look the other way. The Federal Reserve's doing it. The politicians are doing it. And like you had said, the Fortune 100 CEOs are doing the same thing.
That's right. So no real problem solving occurs on the sunny day. That's what Howe's saying. Problems like that are faced when people have no other choice. And it is a really grim day. That's what he said in that interview. It's a white knuckle time. It's where horrible things are happening. At least historically, we've seen that geopolitically around the world. And that's when people are forced to act. You and I, Kevin, look at debt and we say, this is a big problem. Is a very big problem. And for the mucky mucks, they'd say it's not a big problem because we have something at our fingertips that you don't have, and that's the power to coerce. And when you introduce coercion into the equation, guess what? Basic 2 plus 2 doesn't have to equal 4. It can be whatever we want it to be because we can force the equation. We can force the variables. And if you don't like it, we'll force your face into the mud. I mean, this is the nature of politics. It gets dirty at a certain point. And I think this is where we're at in this time frame.
Well, and Dave, as a businessman, you understand that to solve a problem, you have to compartmentalize the problem. If you have a problem with advertising, you sit down and you solve the problem with advertising. If you have a problem with payables, you sit down and work on the payables problem. But Howe goes on to say that in a fourth turning, the issues get muddled. Everything sort of culminates. All the problems at once turn into one gigantic problem. Like World War One. World War One was a really interesting time, Dave, because nobody really knew why they were in the trenches. They just knew they were solving a bigger problem than themselves.
Well, and I think that maybe what's lacking is real executive insight, because the problem of the department head is one of payables.
Right.
The problem of the man who is trying to solve a marketing issue, again, that's within a certain department. The executive is supposed to see everything from a bigger picture perspective.
Sure.
And I don't know that either one of these candidates represents an executive from that standpoint. This is what House says. In our last fourth turning, all the problems of the world, the depression, the trade wars, fascism, everything became one big problem, and that was World War II.
Right.
Total victory, and then that had a climax, which was probably sometime in the fall of 42 and the beginning of 43. This is what Howe says, where we suddenly realized we were probably going to win the thing. And that typically happens in a fourth turning.
So there's a peak. There's a peak that it hits, or a trough.
That's right. All the different problems, all the different struggles all coalesce into one big struggle. Mm-hmm. And there's a climax. And then the final moment of the fourth turning is the resolution. And that's when all the treaties are signed. That's when all the new institutions are created. That's when the cement is wet so that things are free to be shaped any way you want them.
Think about the Marshall Plan. Think about Bretton Woods. All those things came right at that moment.
That's right. That's why Howe says people are going to become masterminds of a whole new global system,
mm-hmm.
which is, you can imagine, at the end of a fourth turning, it is all going to be aided and abetted by millennials, designing these enormous information technology systems to make sure that we are all looked after, like in a game of Sims or something like a giant Sim City. That's his perspective, where we're at in the context of a fourth turning. It is the millennials, which are the generation with the opportunity to reshape the world.
Right.
Whether that's a new Bretton Woods system, whether that's a new IMF, whether that's a new World Bank, or a variety of IT-driven solutions to solve problems in healthcare, elder care, a more sustainable welfare system. My question is, what are the values that they promote? And are those values refined and defined over the next 4 to 8 years in the context of crisis?
Well, unless we sound like we're just talking about cold, hard facts about these fourth turnings are seasoned with horrible amounts of blood. And I know that it can hit us personally because we all have families. We have cares. You know, I'm thinking just about families that are young right now, Dave.
What concerns me is the period of conflict preceding regeneracy, which happens to encompass the time frame in which my boys are recruitable. So in this election, I'm interested in who is likely to take us to war. It's a late stage concern for me if you're assuming a two-term president that's reelected on the basis of concerns and crisis which compel the electorate to stick with the horse they know. But in that future scenario, we have millennials that are directly impacted by the crisis. That includes my kids. Mm-hmm. And we're talking about lives that are marked by conflict.
Right.
We're talking about a predisposition of hopefulness, which is characteristic of this generation, absolutely prerequisite to being the ones that make significant changes culturally, socially, politically. This is probably the most civic-minded group of people we've had in 50, 60 years. They are a very collectively aware generation, the most so since the Great Depression. But I want to know what values they are going to champion. And I want to know if the consequences of major economic decline doesn't have them spitting mad about things that are market related, spitting mad about things that are truly a part of the solution that lies ahead, not the problem, which is entrepreneurialism and creativity and innovation. They have at their fingertips technologically advantaged solutions, which I can't even wrap my mind around. But to the next generation are the no-brainer things that, again, to an older generation, we couldn't see it, we can't see it, we can't solve the problems the way they can. Again, what is at the heart of the next generation? That's my concern. If I'm thinking about legacy, I'm not just thinking about who's president. I'm interested in who and what experiences define the next generation.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. Or you can call us at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.